Chapter 7, Shedding New Light on the Great Pyramid. Are we walking around in a hypnotic trance? Have we forgotten that we have lived before and will live again? Are we connected to all the living things around us on a direct conscious level? Is there a working third eye in the center of our brains? Are there techniques we can practice that will allow us to venture directly into the source field and perform seemingly impossible miracles? Can others go there with us at the same time and experience the same things? Is the 25,920-year cycle just a wobble in the Earth's axis? Did the ancients give us a working source field technology, pyramids, as a way of revealing that this source field can indeed be harnessed and directed for the benefit of all life on Earth? Is the Great Pyramid ultimately our single best piece of surviving evidence to prove that our ancestors had very highly advanced technology? Does it also give us the tools to reconstruct their lost ancient science? The Great Pyramid is considered the largest stone building on Earth, covering some 13 acres at its base, the equivalent of 7 midtown city blocks in Manhattan, and it rises to the height of a 40-story building. Approximately 2.3 million limestone and granite blocks were used to build it, each of them weighing 2.5 to 70 tons apiece, for a total mass of about 6.3 million tons. No crane ever built in modern times is strong enough to lift stones this heavy. It would simply tumble over. The bedrock underneath the Great Pyramid was leveled out so perfectly that no corner of the pyramid's base is more than a half inch higher or lower than the others. Such precise leveling goes significantly beyond even the finest architectural standards of today. Strangely, the pyramid is also located at the exact center of the Earth's landmass, the one true axis mundi. Its east-west axis sits precisely on the longest land parallel, covering the greatest amount of land and the least amount of water on Earth, passing through Africa, Asia, and America along the way. The longest land meridian, crossing over Asia, Africa, Europe, and Antarctica, also passes right through the pyramid. The likelihood of finding this perfect location by accident is 1 in 3 billion. I didn't understand why this location was so important until years later, as we will see, but it has to do with the flow and positioning of natural energy fields from the Earth that have remained unknown to mainstream scientists in our own modern times. The sides of the pyramid line up so well with true rotational north that they only deviate by 3 minutes of arc in any one direction, less than 0.06%. Another coincidence is that if you calculate the average height of land above sea level, with Miami as the low and the Himalayas as the high, you come out with 5,449 inches. Which is the exact height of the Great Pyramid. To me, the most surprising fact of all was that when the Great Pyramid was first built, it was covered with 21 acres of gleaming, brightly polished white casing stones, a total of about 115,000 blocks of pure white limestone, averaging 100 inches or 8.3 feet in thickness. If you caught the glint of the sun's reflection off of these stones in the daytime, it would be blindingly bright, thus earning it the name Takut, or the light. The reflections could apparently be seen from the mountains of Israel hundreds of miles away. Despite the fact that some of these casing stones weighed 16 tons, all 6 sides were carved to fit together so perfectly that the cracks between them were only 1/50th of an inch wide, which is narrower than a human fingernail. Sir Flinders Petrie described this in the late 1800s as the finest optician's work on the scale of acres, comparing it to the precision used to grind lenses for a telescope. Richard C. Hoagland has pointed out that even the tiles on a NASA space shuttle do not fit together this closely. Even more surprisingly, these cracks are not empty. They are filled with a cement that is incredibly strong. There is no known way you could fit a mortar into cracks 1/50th of an inch wide and evenly cover areas as large as 5 feet by 7 feet wide in the vertical with any known methods. And if you were foolhardy enough to smash the casing stones with a sledgehammer, you would find that the limestone itself breaks before the cement does. I'm well aware of how fantastic this must sound. It's one thing to see the pyramid sitting there as it is today, a giant mass of decaying stone blocks. It would be quite something else to witness it in its original form, looking like a gigantic, gleaming white sculpture in the desert, something totally unlike any other technological achievement we've ever seen on Earth, whether from ancient times or in our modern world. Thankfully, many people witnessed these casing stones in their original form and documented their observations in writing over the centuries, and the history can be found in Peter Tompkins' Secrets of the Great Pyramid. According to Tompkins, limestone becomes harder and more polished with time and weather, unlike marble. Think about the gorgeous stalactites and stalagmites of limestone you can find in underground caves. Therefore, the pyramid did not get progressively more dull-looking as the centuries rolled by after it was first built. In approximately 440 BC, Herodotus wrote that the pyramid's casing stones were highly polished, with joints so fine they could scarcely even be seen with the naked eye. The 13th century Arab historian Abd al-Latif said that despite their polished appearance, these stones were inscribed with mysterious, unintelligible characters, enough to fill 10,000 pages. His colleagues assumed these writings were the graffiti of ancient tourists. William of Baldensall visited the pyramid in the early 1300s and described these strange inscriptions as being all arranged in long, careful rows of strange symbols. When the casing stones eventually were lost, so went any hope of documenting these mysterious writings for future code-breaking analysis and study. Diodorus Siculus, who lived soon after the time of Christ, wrote that the casing stones were complete and without the least decay. The Roman naturalist Pliny witnessed native boys running up the polished sides to the delight of tourists. In about AD 24, Strabo visited Egypt and said there was an entrance on the north face of the pyramid that was made of a hinged stone you could raise from the bottom up, but was otherwise indistinguishable from its surroundings when it lay flush. Inside the Great Pyramid, there are three different chambers. The largest of these is known as the King's Chamber, and is the only part of the pyramid that is made of red granite, which is extremely hard. In the 1990s, Bernard Peach analyzed the 20 different stones on the floor of the King's Chamber and made startling discoveries. Strangely, although the stones are all either square or rectangular, hardly any of them are the same size, except when you have an identical pair side by side. These stones are arranged in a series of 6 different rows, and each row has a different width from any of the others. In Anatomy of the King's Chamber, Peach presents staggeringly complex and compelling evidence that a variety of measurements from Mercury, Venus, Earth, the Moon, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, including their orbital periods, are encoded in the stone's dimensions. Within the King's Chamber, there is a loose stone coffin carved out of an extremely hard chocolate-brown granite, estimated to weigh 3 tons. The external volume of the sarcophagus is exactly twice the internal volume. Thanks to the patterns of circular drill marks found inside, engineer Christopher Dunn calculated that the coffin was carved out by tubular drills that could cut through granite 500 times faster than any technology we now have available. In Chapter 13, I propose this is actually the result of a technology that can dramatically soften stone. Skeptics believe this may have been done with diamond-tipped drill bits in Egypt, despite the impossibility of achieving the necessary speeds involved with any modern technology. Dunn points out that the strongest metal they had at the time was copper. The diamonds would have cut through the copper like butter before they ever even put a dent in the granite. The sarcophagus has grooves for a lid to be fitted in place, but no such lid has ever been found, as if it were never intended to be found. Many pyramid researchers, including Peter Lemazurier, interpret this open tomb as symbolizing a time when there will be no more death, i.e., the coming golden age. The coffin was empty, and there is no evidence it ever held a mummy. The granite sarcophagus also cannot fit through the antechamber, meaning that it had to be built into the pyramid from the very beginning, totally in contrast with any known Egyptian burial practices. Although this was not discovered until much later, the north and south walls of both the king's chamber and the queen's chamber also contained air shafts that went on an upward sloping angle, all the way out to the surface of the pyramid. This supplied just enough oxygen to refresh the atmosphere inside each room. In the mid-1990s, Rudolf Gantenbrink sent a miniature robot some 65 meters up the shafts and confirmed that in the king's chamber, the south shaft points at the star Al-Nitak, or Zeta Orionis. The north shaft points at Alpha Draconis, which used to be the pole star in the 3rd millennium BC. The northern queen's chamber shaft is aimed at Beta Ursa Minoris, and the southern channel points to Sirius. All these alignments date back to about 2500 BC. That was the most recent time in which they all lined up. According to ancient civilizations researcher Joseph Jachmans, as Bouval and Gilbert showed through computer calculations, the constellational alignments imprinted in the air passages for 2450 BCE were also present earlier, in about 10,500 BCE, because of the precession of the equinoxes. An Edgar Cayce reading from June 30, 1932, said that work on the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx began this very same year. In the 13th century, an Arab historian compared the pyramid to a gigantic female breast, noting the casing stones still looked perfect on the outside except for the original entrance carved by Caliph al-Ma'mun. Disaster struck in the year 1356 as the first of a series of earthquakes leveled significant areas of northern Egypt, collapsing entire city blocks to rubble. The pyramid was shaken so hard by these quakes that many of the casing stones broke off and tumbled into a giant mess. The people were desperate to rebuild and used this fallen limestone from the pyramid as raw material to help build the new capital city, El Kahira, the Victorious, as well as to rebuild Cairo. Apparently, the stones that hadn't already fallen off were then deliberately broken off because the quality of the limestone was very pure and provided an excellent building material. According to the French Baron d'Anglure, who visited this area of Egypt in 1396, certain masons demolished the course of great casing stones which covered the pyramid and tumbled them into the valley. Two bridges were built across the Nile specifically to help drag the stones across the river via camel trains so as to build mosques and palaces in Cairo and El Kahira. As the centuries rolled by, the legend of the once great casing stones had faded into nothing more than a superstitious myth. However, Colonel Vyse conducted excavations in and around the pyramid beginning in 1836 that permanently eliminated the skeptics' arguments. Vyse found that the pyramid was surrounded by debris of limestone chunks and sand that had piled up around the base by as much as 50 feet. He cleared a patch in the center of the north facade, hoping to reach the base and bedrock of the pyramid. There he found two of the original casing stones, forever ending the scholarly argument about whether the pyramid had ever been covered with a perfectly flat, polished white surface. The original blocks were still so finely carved that an exact measurement of the slope angle could be calculated. According to Vise, they were perfect. In a sloping plane as correct and true, almost as modern work by optical instrument makers. The joints were scarcely perceptible, not wider than the thickness of silver paper. Vise published his detailed measurements and notes in 1840, and his assistant John Pering published his own book as well. This opened up a whole new phase of study known as pyramidology. John Taylor, a gifted mathematician, an amateur astronomer who worked as an editor of the London Observer in the 19th century, was already in his 50s when Vise's data came in from Egypt. Taylor then began a rigorous 30-year investigation into all the measurements that had been reported in and around the pyramid, looking for hidden mathematical and geometric formulas. Taylor found that if he measured the perimeter of the base in inches, it came out to roughly 100 times 366. And if he divided the perimeter by 25 inches, he got 366 once again. What's the big deal about 366? It is suspiciously close to the exact length of an Earth year, 365.2422 days. Taylor found that by slightly changing the length of a typical British inch, these figures could become exact reflections of the Earth year. Was this merely a cheap mathematical cheat, or was there any worthwhile science behind it? That question was soon answered when a highly fortunate coincidence struck at almost the exact same time. Sir John Herschel, one of Britain's most highly regarded astronomers at the turn of the 19th century, had very recently tried to invent a new measuring unit to replace the existing British system. He wanted it to be based on the exact dimensions of the Earth. Without knowing anything about Taylor's research, Herschel used the most accurate dimensions of the Earth available at the time to suggest that we should be using inches that were very slightly longer than normal, by a mere half the width of a human hair, or 1.00106 British inches. Herschel blasted the French for basing their metric system on the curvature of the Earth, which can change, rather than using a line that went straight through the Earth's center from pole to pole. A recent British Ordnance survey had fixed that pole-to-pole distance within the Earth as 7,898.78 miles, or 500,500,000 British inches. It would become exactly 500 million inches if the British inch were made just a slight bit longer. Herschel argued that the existing British inch should be officially lengthened to obtain this truly scientific measuring unit. 50 of these inches would then be exactly 1/10 millionth of the Earth's polar axis. 25 of them would make a very useful cubit, which could replace the existing British yard and foot. Little did Herschel know that Taylor had already discovered these exact same units within the dimensions of the Great Pyramid. When Taylor found out about this, he was thrilled. He now had compelling evidence that the builders of the pyramid must have known the true spherical dimensions of the planet and built their whole measurement system off it. That again implies that the ancient Egyptians possessed a significantly more advanced technology than we normally give them credit for. Le Mesurier reported that in International Geophysical Year 1957, the Earth's diameter from pole to pole was measured with flawless satellite precision, much more accurately than in Herschel's time. As a result, we now know that the pyramid inch is indeed 1/500 millionth of the Earth's diameter at the poles, and this connection is so exact that the numbers check out down to multiple decimal points of accuracy. This means the pyramid was indeed built to be a mathematically perfect reflection of the length of a year on Earth around its perimeter. These precisely Earth-scaled measurements appear again and again in obvious ways, both inside and outside the pyramid. However, an even greater mystery is found when we measure the diagonals of the Great Pyramid, namely the distance from one corner over the top and down to the other corner. This distance comes out to 25,826.4 pyramid inches, remarkably close to modern calculations of the true length of the precession of the equinoxes in years. It definitely seems that the Great Pyramid's designers wanted us to use the Egyptian inch. By making the pyramid's diagonals add up to the precession of the equinoxes in Egyptian inches, we seem to have been given a message to pay attention to this great cycle. These same builders obviously knew the exact dimensions of the earth, and therefore may very well have traveled the world, seeding many different ancient myths in many different ancient cultures. As Santayana and Van de Schend revealed again and again in Hamlet's Mill, the hidden message in each of these ancient myths told us to look at the precession, or what many ancient cultures also called the Great Year. The primitive mountain, Benben stone, Shiva lingam, Omphalos, Betel, and Kaaba stone, not to mention the redundant worldwide pinecone symbolism of the Mayan, Egyptians, Hindus, Buddhists, Greeks, and Romans, also suggests there was once a worldwide awareness that the end of the Great Year would somehow involve the awakening of the pineal gland. The Great Pyramid now appears to be yet another way in which our ancestors attempted to permanently preserve this message for future generations. The Vatican seems to know about it, as they put an open Egyptian-style sarcophagus directly behind their gigantic pinecone statue, which was flanked with Bennu phoenix birds. If the Great Pyramid does have a symbolic story to tell, another obvious part of the message would be that it was deliberately left unfinished on the outside. There is a flat, square area at the top where a pyramid-shaped capstone, another form of the Betel stone, can be fitted. When we remember how well the Great Pyramid preserves the Earth's exact measurements, it is no surprise that Peter Lemaizurier, the author of Great Pyramid Decoded, suggested the flattened top meant the Earth itself, like the Great Pyramid, is somehow unfinished. It could be that the folks who built the pyramid intended to return at some point, perhaps the end of the Great Year, to finish the job they started. The return of the capstone also transforms the pyramid from a six-sided object, with a base, four sides, and a top, to a five-sided object. According to Lemaizurier, in Egyptian numerology, six means imperfection, and five means divine initiation. Given that we see the exact length of an earth year in the perimeter, as well as the exact length of the precession in the diagonals, this suggests that the cycle of precession will ultimately remove the imperfections of humanity by moving us through a divine initiation of some kind.